General MacArthur, new commander-in-chief in the Southwest Pacific, today considered military plans prepared for him before his arrival. Guarded by armed sentries in his temporary city hotel headquarters, General MacArthur has settled down to his first task. He's expected to make only brief to the point announcements from time to time as the need arises. Australian newspapers reiterate the faith of the Australian people in their new leader and pledge unswerving support. The Sydney Sunday Telegraph points out that the United States forces now falling to Australia are the first overseas troops stationed here for 72 years. The last before the Americans were the 14th and 18th regiments of the British Army, which left in 1870. The Sunday Sun says that American forces, with their easygoing manners and spirit of comradeship, have quickly made friends with the Australians. The Australian Hospitality League is working with the recently established American Centre to arrange visits by Americans to Australian private homes in the city and country while the men are on leave. Australians everywhere are giving their American friends as much entertainment as is consistent with American headquarters statements that the forces have a great deal of work to do and not much time to play. Two Japanese cruisers are now reported to have been seriously damaged by mines from Allied planes which attacked Rabaul on Friday. One of the warships was left in a sinking condition and may have been sunk. Hits on the southern ships were announced in a supplementary communique issued in Canberra last night. New Guinea war correspondents report that an unexploded bomb found after a recent Japanese raid had European letters on the casing and not the normal Japanese hockey. The bomb is thought to be from either a German or an Italian factory. The newsmen point out that Japan may still be able to draw on stocks received from other Axis countries. So she must have been getting vast supplies of bombs from Germany and Italy for a considerable time before the threat was Pearl Harbor attack. No talks between Allied forces and Japanese troops in the Martin Valley of New Guinea has been reported, but contact is believed to be imminent. The Japanese are extending their control of the area by moving further inland from Ney and Panama. The Sydney Sunday Telegraph correspondent of Port Moresby says that if the Japanese try to go across country to this town, they must pass through the hunting grounds of the Kuku cannibals, that's called K-U-K-U. The cuckoo cannibals in the dense mountain forest. The cuckoos, he said, are the only tribe in eastern New Guinea which the right administration could never control. Army guns would be ineffective in fighting them, because the first thing their victims knew of an attack when they were struck by was when they were struck by deadly little black arrows. Patrol officers and native police have disappeared in this country without leaving a trace. Tribal warfare and head hunting have broken out in the wild Pacific River country, New Guinea. S-E-C-I-K, Pacific River, since the White Administration has withdrawn. The Northern Herald New Guinea correspondent says that he learned of native outbreaks from members of a party of white people who reached Port Moresby from Wayback, W-E-W-A-K, after 1 month's perilous travel. One of the persons said, quote, "It's as bad as the riotous, perilous days of the early frontier settlement." One of the bad natives are police boys who've thrown away their badges. Withdrawal of control after 30 years may be followed by battles between tribes, which are probably the wildest in the modern world. Unquote. The correspondent says that some plantations and homes have been wrecked and plundered by the natives. Even a billion hermit sites have been taken. The natives have taken all those sites into the inland, where new villages have been set up. These villages may become bases for raiding parties against both black and white settlers. Outbreaks among native tribes, as the correspondent, are very likely largely due to the activities of pro-Nazi missionaries, who have taught the natives to regard the Japanese as friends and to spread discord and insurrection among other tribes. Australia's war costs are rising steeply and have taken a big jump since the plan ended the war. Political correspondents in the national capital say that war expenditure this year will be $975 million compared with the $740 million that Treasurer Tiffany provided for in his last plan. Total war and civil expenditure next year is expected to be $1,300 million. This expenditure has to be borne by a country of just on 7 million people, and it is a heavy toll on taxpayers. Australians have shown by their response to the last federal loan, which they oversubscribed by about $36 million, that they are ready to give all they have. And no political correspondent doubts that people will rise uncomplainingly to any demand that may be made upon the new war expenditure. A great program of allied work, which has already begun, will meet the needs of American forces in Australia and will strengthen the country both economically and strategically. The next federal budget is expected to be framed on the basis of a single Commonwealth income tax, instead of the several state taxes which are collected now. The federal government will take all income tax money under the proposed plan and compensate the states for their financial loss. Two committees are now working out details. One consists of taxation experts and the other of members of Parliament. Both committees are expected to submit their reports by the end of next week. These reports will go also to state trainers. A widespread interchange of craft and regimental articles between the Australian and other allied forces in Australia has been suggested by Dr. C.E.W. Bean, the official war historian whose monumental work on the history of the Great War has not long been completed. He said that this was done when Australian and American divisions were fighting shoulder to shoulder in the Great War and that American records were full of evidence of the success of the past. Dr. Bean said that when Brigadier General Elliott was allotted American troops to train with his own Australian brigade in France 1918, he sent groups of American officers and NCOs to take command of Australian platoons and sections. The Americans found this idea of great value when the Australian forces and the U.S. forces were brought together. When the 27th and 30th U.S. divisions were attached to the Australian Corps in 1918, an Australian military mission of about 200 officers and NCOs joined them. This was probably the biggest experiment in liaison ever attempted on the Western Front. A device that will enable sailors, airmen, and soldiers to learn to navigate by the stars after one flight instruction has been made by Dr. Woolnock, former geological advisor to the Commonwealth Government. A tin, a pencil, and three small pieces of paper replace all the usual instruments of navigation and astronomy. Experts have set the device and found it accurate to within less than a quarter of a degree. The principle involves a new view of the heavens, and the invention reproduces the earth and heavens as they would be seen from a point beyond the farthest known star. Dr. Woolnough became interested in navigation and astronomy when he accompanied Sir Edward David on his South Seas expedition. He has thought about it now for 40 years, and in September he found the solution of his problem. Dr. Woolnough's system is expected to be particularly valuable in aircraft because it finds a plane's position in a fraction of the time required by other methods. Major General Gordon Bennett described guerrilla methods in Malaya in an interview yesterday. He said that 1,000 enemy troops were destroyed in one delaying action by a small Australian force. The men hid on both sides of a bridge which was heavily mined. A few Australians went out and met an approaching Japanese column. Both men retreated from the column and led the Japanese over the bridge. The bridge was then blown up, killing 500 Japanese. A few who had been allowed to cross were then annihilated. On another occasion, Australians armed with Molotov cocktails destroyed four enemy tanks. Our anti-tank guns waited until the center of the enemy tank column was hidden by a dip in the road and unable to attack. The anti-tank guns then put out of action the leading and the rear flanks of the enemy column so that the rest of the column could neither advance nor retreat. Men armed with Molotov cocktails rushed forward and threw them into the tank pattern. And here's a late message which has just come in. Japanese forces in the Markham Valley made a sortie today and destroyed four Australian junks 10 miles from Salamina. Army officers say the situation is well intact. And in today's news review from Australia, read by John Roy. And here is our commentary on the news of the day. There are still some commentators in America and Britain who feel that we in Australia are making too much of the importance of our capital in the general strategy of the war against Japan. These commentators feel that we are much too importunate in our insistence on the crucial part that Australia must play in the Allied Council of Nations. In particular, we are charged with underestimating the importance of India. These commentators claim that a careful study of Japan's policy will show that it is Asia and not Australia that the Tokyo imperialists first fight. India, not Australia, is the main target of Japanese aggression. A successful attack against India would bring the Japanese untold advantages. It would give them the enormous wealth and resources of India itself. It would give them a secure land barrier to protect their conquests of Indochina, Thailand, Malaya, and Burma. It would give them complete mastery of China. For with the possession of India, China would be effectively encircled and her lifeline severed. In the long run, the conquest of India would give Japan an overwhelming strategic advantage for the inevitable struggle in the Soviet Union. Lastly, the conquest of India would unite the two ends of the axis. Germany and Japan would then despise the whole continent of Europe and Asia. On this reading of the world situation, it is argued that the defense of Australia is at a secondary importance. We Australians are therefore urged not to take too selfish and insular a view. But we don't agree that this means that the defense of Australia should be in any sense secondary to the defense of India. These are not two problems, but a single problem. It is not to fight the claims of India, but because of the claims of India that we insist on the primary urgency of building great allied strength in Australia. There are not two ways to defend India. There are two ways to defend India. We can try to secure its safety by resisting with land forces the tremendous land offensive Japan is now launching through further. Or we can try to destroy Japan's power to mount this offensive. To reduce the strength of the blows which Japan can aim at India. We can only do this from Australia. It's only from Australia that a really decisive counter-offensive can be launched against Japan. Because it's only from Australia that the sea power and air power of the Allied nations can be brought to play. It is on the land that Japan possesses the greatest strength. It's on the sea and in the air that Japan is weakest. This is still true despite the setback Japan imposed on the Allied sea power last December. Hence, when we Australians persist in maintaining the primary urgency of reinforcing Australia, we are not merely concerned with the defense of this country. We believe that it's only by using Australia as a sea and air base that the Japanese menace to India can be destroyed. If Japan can succeed in putting Australia out of this war, she can proceed in the most leisurely and comfortable fashion to deploy the whole of her forces against India. In the country she has already conquered, she can develop resources which will enable her to carry on a great and sustained campaign in the continent of Asia. This means that to lose Australia would not merely mean the loss of an allied outpost in the South Sea, it would mean the loss of all effective power to use the sea and the air in the fight against Japan. It would mean, moreover, that the enormous power of the United States would be almost useless in the defense of India. For if American resources are to be effectively employed in India's defense, they must be brought by sea to the area of military operations. But American men and machines can be brought across the Pacific to Southeast Asia only if America controls the sea areas. She can only control the sea areas by naval power in the Western Pacific. This means naval bases in the Southwest Pacific. And Australia and New Zealand are the only countries that can provide these bases. We therefore believe that to discuss the defense of India and the defense of Australia as though they were two separate problems is misleading and dangerous. The defense of India, Australia, and all allied areas threatened by Japan is a single and indivisible problem. the only effective defense is practice. Australia provides the only real base from which the sea, air, and land power of the Allies can be effectively used. Hence, the strength of Australia as a base for a great counter-offensive is the essential condition of the destruction of Japan. And it's only through the destruction of Japan that the United Nations of Asia and the Pacific can in the end be made secure. You're listening to Australia.